I remember Declan Kidney shouting in messages saying, Wally used to go number 8, I'm go 7 and Dunica 6. I just kind of stayed at number 8 and ignored it.
The Red 78 with Alan Quinlan and Niamh Briggs. Subscribe to the Rugby Channel on the OTB Sports app and turn on your notifications now.
OTB AM with Gillette. Put your best face forward with our new and improved razors.
087-9180-180 is the WhatsApp number. You can get in touch with us this morning about that if you want. We'll talk about Man United with Daniel Harris in a few minutes. Is there more about that game?
Yeah, just put together some match notes on it last night. Decided, you know, I'm going to watch Everton versus Newcastle. I'm going to keep a list, a chronological list of my internal monologue last night. So for anybody who didn't watch it, here is the match notes from last night. So pre-match, no cheeky smile from Frank Lampard. No quick transition to no, but seriously, in his interview, has Lampard changed? Has his mood darkened? Is this going to be a grim evening? 5 minutes into the game, Everton have handed possession back to Newcastle three times already. 6 minutes, Seamus Coleman with a header back to Pickford, a header that could only be performed by the greatest right back in history. 8 minutes, Chesney Brown from Coronation Street has had a child and his name is Anthony Gordon. 9 minutes, Coleman with a cross to the head of Townsend, who makes a mess of the header. Best cross ever in Premier League history, though. 10 minutes, Eddie Howe taken out by Seamus Coleman. What an honour for the Newcastle manager to feel the touch of the greatest fullback in the history of football. 11 minutes, Lampard is playing three at the back, it seems. He taught those Chelsea players everything they know in that system. 12 minutes, has Richarlison got Joelinton's hairstyle, or has Joelinton got Richarlison's hairstyle? 13 minutes, Callum Wilson is holding court in the crowd. Chris Sutton nails his co-commentary responsibility by delivering the utterly essential line, they could do with him. A little too early in the game for him to say, penny for his thoughts, so well played Chris Sutton, tidy work. 17 minutes, Coleman nicks the ball off Alan Saint-Maximin. ASM thinks he's been fouled, but actually he's just been given a lesson by the Premier League's greatest ever footballer. 21 minutes, hold on, does Dele Alli also have the Richarlison / Joelinton hairstyle now too? 24 minutes, no, Dele Alli has a ginger top, he's coming on. 29 minutes, Coleman cross, too high for Richarlison, but clearly Richarlison's fault for not being tall enough. The greatest player in the Premier League always crosses perfectly. 32 minutes, Yerry Mina is now injured. Newcastle play on despite him being down and Joelinton misses the chance. Disgraceful lack of sportsmanship. This has really changed my opinion of Newcastle United Football Club and everything they stand for. 33 minutes, Shelvey goes in with a heavy challenge on Gordon and he gets booked. Shelvey appears to have forgotten it was Everton who were meant to be angry after the previous moment of play. 34 minutes, Gareth Southgate is here sitting beside Amanda Staveley and her husband. I'm greatly looking forward to seeing Jonjo Shelvey run the midfield for England and Qatar this year. 36 minutes, goal for Everton after Jamal Lascelles gets in the way of a Matt Target goal line clearance. 37 minutes, he wouldn't like Jamal Lascelles when he's angry. He's decided it's time for Everton to feel the embarrassment of scoring an own goal. 43 minutes, Jordan Pickford kicks the ball straight out of play. Jordan Pickford is now shouting at his teammates once again after shouting at his teammates for conceding an own goal a few minutes previously. 45 minutes plus 3 for injury time. Proper League One stuff here. This is what we live for. Goal mouth scramble because Joelinton slips as he's about to strike for goal in acres of space in the box. He gets his body into such a weird position where he manages to kick the ball off his own head. 52 minutes. Oh my word, Seamus Coleman has just played a beautiful ball from his own half right into the chest of Dele Alli. But unfortunately, the ball has been played right into the chest of Dele Alli and he can't control and the chance is gone. This is not going well for him. 55 minutes. Donny van de Beek is in his familiar place, warming up. You can see it in his eyes that he is hoping beyond hope that the manager does look over to him and he hears for the first time ever, get in there, Donny. 56 minutes, goal for Bournemouth, Ryan Fraser. Dele Alli gives the ball away and proceeds to not track back very well. Chris Sutton does not approve. This is not going well. 59 minutes, oh my God, it's happening, it's happening. Donny van de Beek is about to play half an hour of a Premier League football match. Praise the Lords for Andre Gomez's yellow card. He's been hooked by Frank. Donny has arrived. 62 minutes, question. It would be objectively funny if Frank Lampard got relegated, but why? What has he done to us? 63 minutes, Chris woulda, coulda, shoulda with another opportunity to score his first Premier League goal since November, but he doesn't manage to get on the end of an Alan Saint-Maximin ball. 65 minutes, Jordan Pickford tries to clear the ball for a throw-in, but it goes straight up in the air, sarcastic cheers from the home crowd. Brant Waite then tries to clean it up, but he swings at fresh air and the ball whacks off his standing foot and out it goes for a corner. The sarcastic cheers are now bellows. Pickford isn't even angry this time, he's just disappointed. 69 minutes, Andros Townsend touches the ball in an astonishing development. 72 minutes, Seamus Coleman swings a boot and misses the ball, slicing it, but to a teammate. Even when he's mortal, he's still a god of this game. 78 minutes, the Saudi Arabian Public Investment Fund should write Alan Saint-Maximin a blank check. 80 minutes, boom, Kieran Trippier back of the net. Jordan Pickford here has left a gap in the wall to invite one specific shot from Trippier, but he unfortunately can't save that one specific shot from Kieran Trippier. Staveley and co are high-fiving in the expensive seats. You've got to feel thrilled for them. Gareth Southgate is third-wheeling big time now, though. 84 minutes, Alli slips, tries to slip Richarlison through, but he's got his back turned, and the ball trickles out over the end line. This is not going well.
87 minutes, Ali goes down too easily in the box as he shoved off the ball and gives up appealing for a penalty after 3 milliseconds. This is not going well. 90 minutes, debut for Bruno Guimarães. The phones are out in the stands. £40 million of good, clean, honest money made flesh. 93 minutes, Bruno performs a backheel. Transfer fee paid back immediately. 94 minutes, Ali nails Joe Linton. That's for the hair. This is not going well. Full time, the director's box goes crazy. Southgate still not included in any of the hugging.
If you want to get in touch with us this morning, 0879 180 180 is the WhatsApp number, or of course you can leave a comment on the YouTube stream, hashtag OTBAM. Here's what's coming up between now and 10 o'clock. We're going to speak with Daniel Harris at 10 past 8. We've got the sports pages at half 8. Daniel Kinahan featuring prominently on the front pages. The sports news, John Duggan, and then we'll bring you Keith Wood's thoughts about Ireland-France at the weekend. And then obviously a big launch yesterday from the LGFA ahead of the new league season, and we'll also play some of Dan McDonald on the FAI launch yesterday. Before we get to that with Nathan, we've got a special competition for you this morning. Aer Lingus is the official airline sponsor of the Irish rugby team, bringing home advantage to wherever the team plays. And to celebrate, we have a legitimately amazing prize: a pair of match tickets, flights and 2 nights accommodation to be won for this weekend's Six Nations clash between France and Ireland, as well as a signed jersey. Daily winners get an Ireland jersey to win the chance of winning, and all you got to do is tell us our mystery voice.
At least they download the first episode.
That's one former Ireland star considering launching his own podcast.
At least they download the first episode.
To enter, you can WhatsApp the answer to 0879 180 180. Tweet us at Off The Ball or comment on the YouTube channel. That was a little sideways glance from you there.
I don't know who it is. I think the context of it, I presume I know who it is. But
each daily winner will get an Ireland jersey and we'll go into the draw. Everybody goes into the draw on Thursday for the grand prize. Here's what Frank Lampard had to say to BT Sport after last night's defeat.
Were they lacking in aggression for you? You know, are they lacking in a bit of confidence as well, do you think?
Yeah, the confidence one smacks you in the face, because I come into the club when they want to run a results that's left them in the position where we're in. So it's my job to change that, but there isn't a magic wand on that front, because this is the Premier League. So the only thing to do is to work and to focus, to look back at the game and just look forward about what we can do in the next games coming up. I mean, it's if anyone thought this was going to be easy because we beat Brentford in the Cup, it was never going to be that. So it puts a real sharp focus on it for us, and I've got a real belief in the squad, but we must build that confidence, and we must, where we saw confidence go through the roof on Saturday in not much time, we saw it go down the opposite way, and that's work for us to do.
Good chance that they're getting sucked into that relegation battle and not getting out of it.
I think they'll be in that relegation battle, but I think they'll survive. They're too good to go down, Jer.
Are they?
I think there is.
Are we sure about that?
Quality. Again, Calvert-Lewin was on the bench last night. If they can't keep him fit, Calvert-Lewin ends up not playing between now and the end of the season, they got themselves a big problem, because the goals ain't coming from anywhere else.
What's more likely to happen? The player who's been injured all season miraculously having a great 2 month window to keep his team in the Premier League, or the injuries to linger on into the summer and him to get a move in the summer? That happens.
Well, that is the key, getting him back fit. I still think Everton are far stronger than Norwich, Watford, Burnley. Now, Burnley, we've the one who, you know, of the track record, have been able to get it done and grinding out the odd point here. I think it's 11 draws for Burnley. It's still just the one win for Burnley all season. But the two signings were very strange signings. Like Dele Alli, we know, is brilliant talent, two-time Young Footballer of the Year. But even at his absolute peak at Tottenham, he was never a player who controlled a game. He was never a player who took a game by the scruff of the neck. He was a player who, you sort of forget, was there for 10, 12 minutes and then would pop up with a moment of genius, would pop up with a brilliant decisive pass or make that run in behind the defence and get a goal. But he wasn't somebody, he never became what people thought he might when he was 18, 19, like the number 8 who could be the box-to-box, who could dominate a midfield in the way a Frank Lampard did at times, that could be involved in everything. That's never been Dele Alli's game. So you wonder where that fits into a side who are really struggling and under enormous pressure at a stadium that is on your back and will be on. I think Frank Lampard will have a good honeymoon period, because I think the fans will be on the players' back pretty quickly around this. And Donny van de Beek, we don't know what sort of player Donny van de Beek is anymore. He can't be a player full of confidence. So it doesn't feel like you're bringing in any steeliness at all to that Everton side. Own touch on the lost Yerry Mina to injury quite early last night. They have a lot of problems at the moment, Everton. I still think they'll just about have enough. But already you're looking at Newcastle and thinking Newcastle are going past Everton quite quickly. So suddenly you're the next one to the bottom three. I would be shocked if they were relegated. But
would you legitimately be shocked? Or like at the end, be like, I'm not really that surprised given the absolute like chaos that reigns behind the scenes, the stories we hear of the salaries, the stuff that the club has been through, the complete lack of any overarching plan, the entire backroom crew moved out, a new one has to come in mid-season. You can't, at the end of the season, when you read the 8,000 words Athletic piece, you'd be like, oh, that all makes sense now.
It does, but a lot of those clubs down the bottom, it always makes sense because they are such a mess. And I think quite a few of those teams down there are in a similar situation. Like, all isn't exactly rosy at Burnley right now. We know what Watford are like. So I think Everton, if they can get through this and regroup during the summer, then they can kick on from there. But you know, Richarlison, who you know I've touched on many times, a player I really like, looks totally disinterested at the moment. Looks like he'd rather be anywhere else. A relegation scrap.
He is not returning your love. That is for sure.
The pressure was just too much for him.
The constant love bombing of Richarlison by you over the last 2.5 seasons has just got too much for him. It's like he's just a bit creeped out by it now.
There is that. I don't want to be in the public sphere where this guy can get near me.
Because the relegation battle a couple of weeks ago, the last time we had Premier League fixtures, looked really exciting. But from what you're saying there, if we accept that Newcastle have turned a corner and Everton are too good to go down, then the bottom three are going to stay the bottom three.
I think the bottom three will stay the bottom three. The only thing you could throw into the mix is like Burnley will have a bounce. They will have to have a bounce at some stage and make a run of it. And you're looking at somebody like Brentford, who've lost their last four games in a row. Their star man, even Tony's over on holidays, and he said, F the club. Does that have an effect? Like, maybe Burnley's start of the season where they catch people by surprise is running out already, and a four-game losing streak suddenly becomes one win in 10 or 11, and then they're right back in that mix again. I think Leeds will have enough to keep out of it. I think Palace are, you know, been really impressive. So I think it's three out of Norwich, Watford, Burnley, Brentford. I don't see Everton. I just don't see Everton in that mix.
All right, we're sticking with the Premier League. West Ham also big winners last night. They beat Watford by a 2-0. That means they go above Manchester United in the race for fourth. Obviously, the real story was David Moyes deciding that Kurt Zouma, who was videoed kicking a cat in the previous 24 hours, was too good to drop. Have a listen. Here he is addressing the Zouma situation. The audio is not great, but we figured that we'd play it for you. Have a listen.
As I said, really, really disappointed because I'm a big animal lover. And I'm someone who cares a lot about my dogs and my horses and all those people who I'm connected with.
Will you speak with him, or will you leave this as a separate matter for the club? Is that how you're approaching this?
Yes, the club are dealing with it, as you well know. I've already spoken to him, and we'll move on as much as we can. We wanted to try and get this game out of the way, and we understand that you know, it's not something which everybody's pleased about. In fact, nobody will be pleased about it. It's a really poor situation.
He was too good to drop. Did you think about dropping and leaving him? No, he's one of my best players. So, because I don't really care what happens, it's irrelevant to me what this man's character is. It's irrelevant to me the fact that he's been pictured kicking an animal, because I'm an animal lover, so therefore it's okay. I love my horses. I've got horses, by the way, you know, subtle flex. I mean, I'm sorry, but don't F with cats. And the backlash here is going to be long and continuous, I think, because there's, like, if you think about what Kurt Zouma did, and if you think about the photograph that went around of Gordon Elliott sitting on a dead horse, like, the horse died of natural causes. This guy is actually pictured kicking a cat and, like, throwing it, slapping it and throwing a shoe at it. I mean, I don't know. I think that
He's thrown petrol all over this situation. Like, it's clearly an incredibly serious issue from a PR point of view, which is how clubs would generally approach this. You leave him out, you hope it dies down, you give him a heavy fine, the player comes out and repents. You don't say, well, what happens over there is nothing to do with the football side of things. Now, we would never look to West Ham as a club for, I think, moral leadership on anything. But David Moyes always felt separate and was trying to change what West Ham were about and give them a bit of, integrity on and off the pitch, and he has let himself down badly here. You cannot play Kurt Zouma after that video emerged of kicking a cat in front of his kids, chasing it around the house to punch it. Like, absolute insanity. And his comments only made it worse. Like, to say, where does that end? It's not a football matter. We know that what happens off the pitch has to have an influence. You have to want a certain type of character in your dressing room. And it seemed quite noticeable at the game last night that it wasn't just the Watford fans who were booing Kurt Zouma. It seemed as though it was the West Ham fans as well, who are looking at this going, what the hell are you doing? Like, this guy is not somebody we want. Not someone we want associated with our club. And from a position where you could probably get away with just leaving him out for the one game and moving on with the way the football world works, it feels now that this is going to become a huge issue for West Ham as to how they deal with Zouma.
Like, I mean, West Ham talking about it before the game, they said that they're dealing with it internally. I mean, if they have dealt with it internally or were trying to deal with it internally, you would see the external impact of it, which is the man not starting in the team. So it feels that West Ham have almost fobbed this issue off on David Moyes, and David Moyes is also kind of trying to disassociate himself from the issue as well, and I guess it hasn't been dealt with, as we've seen so far. I see some West Ham fans on social media, some dyed-in-the-wool West Ham fans, are saying that actually they were saying zoo rather than booing Kurt Zouma last night. A bit of a boo earns moment there, I suspect. And also, of course, the Watford fans, as soon as Kurt Zouma hit the deck about half an hour into proceedings after receiving a kick, they started chanting, "That's how your cat feels," which you have to give Watford fans a bit of credit for that one. Not a chant that we've heard too much in the past. So he didn't get a good reception last night, but he shouldn't have been playing.
Alison Rudd says it all became a tireless pantomime, though, that stuff from the crowd. And it's the type of thing that, like, goes away after a week or two, is what West Ham hope.
Clearly. I would have thought that if you bring such shame on your club, as in any business, but even more so maybe in football, that you're taken out, that you are receiving a hefty fine, whatever the maximum the PFA will allow. You don't get to play for a couple of matches. There's a certain degree of public shaming that you have to go through then as the player, and rightly so. But to sort of brush it under the carpet and say, well, listen, you know, what he does at home has nothing to do with this club. As long as he turns up, trains well, and is one of our best 11 footballers, I'm going to pick him no matter what. Like, what sort of culture does that set in that West Ham dressing room?
Well, and in football generally. And I think that you make the point, we shouldn't really be looking to football for moral guidance. And yet so many people love football, and they love the power that and other sports have to bring people together. And then this stuff just makes you're just reminded that none of this really matters. Again, it's just a bunch
of... It's not even moral guidance here, is it?
It's just a bunch of millionaires having fun, and that's all that matters is that they're all going to get their win bonuses last night. You know, is there a cohort of people in that dressing room who were turning on Zouma last night after the game going, you know, that was bad? Or they're like, yeah, good man, you did well there, you dealt with the pressure well, screw them. Like, that's, I'd say it's more the latter than the former.
To go batten down the hatches immediately, go straight into to that sort of point of view, I guess. Like, it does definitely feel that West Ham are going to play this by saying nothing over the next little while, that they said their statement. And I think even David Moyes is kind of looking across to his the PR person, or the media officer at the top table last night. There is a way in which they're going to try and kill this over the next little while without any real consequences for Zouma. I mean, and even when he talked there about everybody in the dressing room being happy to get their win bonuses and all that, like, even if Kurt Zouma was just denied his win bonus or whatever, the money is, he'll still make a pretty penny next week, and there wouldn't necessarily be any consequence.
No, exactly. There is no consequences, it turns out. There have been no significant consequences. Not for West Ham, for playing him, not for Zouma, for what he did, not for football generally. The circus rolls on and everybody forgets about it in a little while. Like, it will be in 6 months' time, what was the Zouma story again? We're all guilty of it, I think, in some ways. We're all complicit. Right, so that's the story with West Ham. They're up to fourth, which is the most important thing. You know, they're back in the hunt for Champions League. There was a bit of a wobble. They've come out of the wobble the other side. Don't know how good they were against Watford, but let's move on, because the FAI gave a 90-minute press conference yesterday to reflect on a whirlwind 24 hours for them, where the Euros bid was confirmed. How that's going to work in some ways was fleshed out with the other FAs and their chief executives all out yesterday speaking about that. And then or the day before, and then obviously the FAS strategy. Nathan, could you maybe talk to us a little bit about the breakdown in terms of how much focus there was on the draw, the bid, and how much there was on the strategy document in the press conference?
Well, I wasn't in the press conference because it was only for the newspaper journalists. So I had sort of 15 minutes myself with Jonathan Hill and Roy Barrett. It was a sort of day where you would like 90 minutes because it was the first time Jonathan Hill had actually sat down in person with the media. And as you say, Monday alone was a pretty seismic day where you could have spent an hour just talking about the bid, the ramifications, the cost, and leading into the strategy document, which could be one of the most important in the history of Irish football if it can be implemented quite quickly over the next 3 or 4 years. That's before you get into all the other stuff that's always happening around schoolboy football at the moment, around Stephen Kenny's contract, around Anthony Barry, all of that. So this was a rare opportunity actually to spend some time and with Jonathan Hill, see how he works, and very much backed up by Roy Barrett, which I thought was very noticeable yesterday. Roy Barrett was sitting alongside Roy Barrett, the chairman of the FAI, and any questions that were there around Jonathan Hill and the job he's done so far, Roy Barrett was there to give him his absolute full backing that the FAI board are more than satisfied with what Jonathan Hill is doing at the moment. So my conversation probably ended up not spending as much time as would have wanted on the strategy, because I don't think you can really get into it in 12, 15 minutes. It was on the bid, firstly, on the cost of the bid, which they are non-committal on. Jonathan Hill said that there's going to be three people working on it, and that's almost the cost of this, that it is very reasonable. That's not going to have a massive impact on FAI budgets, on, say, implementing the strategy plan. It's not going to be millions upon millions of euro. That a lot of the work was done for the Euro 2020 bid, and a lot of work been done around the World Cup bid. So a good chunk of this is already done. But still, couldn't give an exact figure, which I think everyone wants at the moment, because it does feel as though, you know, every penny is important at the FAI when you are over £50 million in debt. On the strategy document, like, it's clear for the strategy document, like, two things are crucial. Firstly, you need money. It seems they are going to be and having to go back to government for a lot of this, and maybe they're going to get better at utilising the various funds that are available to sporting organisations around different grants, particularly around FAI, around League of Ireland and stadiums. There's an audit due to take place. A good chunk of my conversation was around his working arrangements in the end, because there was a story in the paper that he's not living in Ireland. He's been working remotely. Jonathan Hill said he's in Dublin 5 days a week, so he's going back home at the weekends. His situation with his family is that his children are at a stage of school where they're not in a position to move over right now. Said he's in Dublin 5 days a week. He's in Abbottstown 5 days a week. And actually, there's nobody else in Abbottstown because everybody and the vast majority of the FAI employees are still working from home. So he doesn't see it as a big issue. And to be honest, I'm not quite sure how big an issue it is away from the optics of it. Like, part of you feels that, like, the FAI is such a disparate and difficult, Irish football is so difficult to grasp in terms of the grassroots level and the breakdown between League of Ireland and schoolboys. Like, do you need to be on the ground meeting these people week in, week out? Then you think, John Delaney did that. Like, John Delaney spent every night of the week out meeting the people.
I think that we need to get away from the...
It's hard to.
But you can't say that, like... the fact that John Delaney met people, like, that was about shoring up a power base. That was about making sure that votes would go one direction. That was, like, old school Irish, like, how he went around the country with the chicken and chips circuit, and it was like, I'm going to meet everybody, and then all of a sudden there's this groundswell of support for him. So, like, that's what that was about from Delaney's perspective. If Jonathan Hill was to go on a listening tour to speak to the football people of Ireland, I don't think anybody would say, that's Delaney-esque. Like, there's, you know, Roy Barrett makes the point, we need to forget the past. Like, in some aspects, you absolutely need to learn from the mistakes of the past, but you do also need to do a little bit of a men in black and go, right, we're starting again. And we will actually, it's okay for me to be out listening to and at matches and seeing the crappy facilities, like getting a feel for what it's like to watch the kids changing containers. I made this point, like, you know, the gleaming facilities in the GAA clubs and the kids changing in containers is something that you would hope the body politic of the FAI fully understands. And, like, Damien Duff talked about it when he talked about the dinosaurs and how he was making that comment because look at the facilities and it's something that we need to learn from. You'd hope that Jonathan Hill understands that, but I don't know, because, as you say, we haven't had that much access to him. and those opportunities. Look, to speak to
COVID has had a huge impact on that. And even with him getting out and about and meeting the people, and I think it is important that he meets the people, because you would think as he goes around the country, he'll figure out actually and meet half a dozen figures who he'll be impressed by and think, actually, these are people I want to bring in and to have an influence as well. Whereas if you're not, you're relying on those around you who probably have a preconceived notion, and they're telling you who you should talk to, rather than actually just going and naturally meeting all the people involved in football.
Yeah.
I would expect that he'll be at lots of League of Ireland games off the back of this, and we'll be getting a good sense of the issues around facilities. And it is one of the standout bits of the strategy document, I think, is this audit that's going to take place. Like, they've given themselves a very short time frame, which is great in one way, because it means, you know, we'll have answers by 2025 as to what's actually happened. But also, like, the change that needs to take place in the League of Ireland, and the more you think about it, the weight of expectation that's been put on League of Ireland clubs is absolutely massive around the future of Irish football. So firstly, we're looking at facilities, and then we're looking at academies that League of Ireland clubs are going to be responsible. And most League of Ireland clubs have 1-2 full-time staff. Like, facilities, grants, all of that is time-consuming, energy-sapping, and League of Ireland clubs don't have huge staff to do that. And at the same time, you're saying, transform your grounds, make them better, but also build an academy from scratch, where a lot of these clubs have no reputation in doing it, have no great knowledge in doing it.
Okay.
Are we? I think the FAI will, as part of this, have to give them the resources somehow make all of that more straightforward.
Yeah, you could centralise that resource and then have liaison officers who work with individual clubs around. Once the survey is done, these are your facility requirements, this is your academy requirements, centrally we're applying for this amount of money and you will get this amount over this period of time. It won't be everything, you're going to have to fundraise part of that yourselves, but we commit to giving you X amount and you're going to have to raise the rest. Like, there's templates from World Sport, there's templates from Irish Sport about how to do this. Let's hear from Jonathan Hill. Here he is talking to you about how the Euro 2028 bid came around.
And that to me would be the key, is that if we can have the Irish team part of the tournament itself, I don't think there's any question that the young boys and girls in Ireland, along with many other adults who will be who will enjoy the tournament, will not be inspired to take up the sport of football. That is what we're here to do. And I think that inspiration, you've seen it in previous tournaments when Irish teams have been part of it, the effect on the nation and the galvanising effect on the nation is something only football can do. Yeah? The Irish national football team has an effect on the nation in a way that no other sport in Ireland does. And that would be one really strong reason for me for us to be part of that actual process. Now, look, one of the things that UEFA are looking at is moving from 24 teams to potentially 32 teams taking part in that tournament. Now, if it does go to 32 teams, it would be very much part of our objective, and this may again be written into the 26 to 30 strategic plan, for us to qualify directly to the tournament, whether we're hosting it or not. And I think that the effect on Irish football of having the men's senior team, and by the way, having the women's senior team qualify for a Euro of a World Cup, is absolutely transformative for the game. And that would be my simple answer to your question. It will inspire everyone to become involved in our sport. That's what we're here to do.
So that's about participation. I think that was one of the other kind of things that didn't get talked about a huge. Participation is actually one of the main pillars. If there are loads and loads of people, more people playing football, then they will ultimately end up being football fans, and they can be transformed into national team fans or local League of Ireland fans. I buy that participation is hugely important. It wasn't sold as participation. It was sold as, we want to inspire by getting tournaments here, as opposed to, we want to inspire by getting us two tournaments. And then if tournaments happen to be here in the future, that's great, but we're not going to waste too much time and energy thinking about it. Now, that's that aspect of it. Let's move on, because you did ask him about working as the CEO in Ireland while actually not living here full time.
Have you been able, while not living in the country, been able to grasp all the various different factions that are there within Irish football?
I've been working 12-hour days every day since I started 15 months ago in relation to building my understanding of Irish football and talking to, as you say, all of the many disparate and different stakeholders across the game. So I think I've built up a pretty good understanding of some of the core issues. And by the way, some of them are not rocket science. And to answer your question, one of the things we do need to do is to get people who may have what look like diametrically opposed views on a specific subject into one room so we can talk through the issues to see if we can come up with a solution. And unless we do that, we won't come up with solutions. But that needs everyone to come into the room and to come into the room in the right frame of mind and with the belief that we can find solutions to some of these historical legacy issues that we've got.
Are you going to move to Ireland?
Look, I am. All of this has been complicated by the pandemic. You're very clearly much aware of what's happened in terms of first 6 months that I was in the job. Nobody could move from one place to another. We were all in lockdown anyway. I am now working 5 days a week here in Abbottstown. I'm actually working in an office where there are no other staff in here because the office hasn't been open. But I understand symbolically how important it is for me to be here.
Has it been a concern for the board, Roy?
No, it hasn't been a concern. At a level, it's a little bit strange having this conversation about, you know, somebody not coming to the office and working in the office where for the last couple of years nobody's been able to do that. And as we've evolved through a pandemic, people's attitude to work in the workplace and what's appropriate, what's going to be normal in the future has completely changed. From my perspective, as I look at it, and I probably work the closest with Jonathan, you know, on board in my role, you know, I've a very simple view. I mean, you kind of judge people on outcomes. You judge them on their effectiveness, their productiveness, and their work ethic, and how they go about it. So Jonathan, in my view, and in the board's view, is doing a really excellent job.
It's funny, Nathan, but all of the stuff that we've seen from Jonathan really has been, from Jonathan Hill, has been short sound bites or in-house media stuff. He's actually a very good performer when he's having conversations that are conversational about stuff that he is intimately familiar with. And a bit more of this wouldn't really hurt when it comes to establishing trust, establishing a relationship and establishing credibility. I know everybody's like, oh, John Delaney. And that ghost haunts everybody in all these conversations. But actually, you can't just not do stuff because John Delaney did it. Like, he should be in the media. He should be saying, this is our vision. This is how we're getting those stakeholders together. That point of getting people, it's not rocket science. It's interesting to hear because it may well be Israel-Palestine. It may well be Northern Ireland to try and get Dublin schoolboys and Dublin League of Ireland clubs all heading in the same path. But it might not be, you know? And maybe somebody from outside goes, well, this is a fairly easy solution here. You do this and you do that and we'll pay for this and away we go.
Well, exactly. You don't want to go down the John Delaney route where he didn't speak or answer to the media for 3-4 years at one stage. I think it'd be great for Jonathan Hill to have these sit downs on a regular basis because there is a passion and a huge interest in Irish football. And actually, everyone does want all the detail. They want to get into the minutiae of what you plan around League of Ireland, schoolboy football, Stephen Kenny's contract, sponsorship deals. Everyone is fascinated by all of this and wants to know. And it'd be great to, you know, offer Jonathan Hill the chance to come on the show and sit for an hour and give his vision and have that conversation. And hopefully he'll take it up over the next while. So, yeah, I think he's a very accomplished performer. And, you know, as I say, you can see Roy Barrett has his backing. It was interesting, you know, about his abilities, because I think a couple of the question marks have been about getting a deal done because, you know, it's over 2 months now since he was tasked with securing Stephen Kenny's contract. That still hasn't been done, despite everyone saying that Stephen Kenny wants to stay on and the FAI want him to stay on. But he says it'll definitely be done in the next month or so. Obviously, the Anthony Barry news has probably thrown a little bit of a spanner in the works there as well in terms of backroom staff. And the other one then is the sponsorship deal, which maybe is more symbolic than anything else. A sponsor for the men's senior team. He's very keen to point out that they've brought Sky on board for the women's national team, which is a very important deal, which I think most people would agree with. But symbolically for the FAI to say, actually, a big business has come on board. And Roy Barrett was sort of making the point that they probably could have got deals done, but that with every passing month, the FAI's reputation is being restored a little bit more and the results on the pitch are better. So instead of taking the cheap deal 6 months ago, actually getting the full value. And so I think when you break it down into how these decisions work, like, it is a sponsorship manager going into CEO saying we should sponsor the men's national team. And
for multi-years.
That's a hard sell at times, I'm sure, when it's a seven-figure deal to sponsor the men's national team, to make that sort of investment when there's always a concern of what's round the corner with the FAI. But maybe that's coming to an end.
Yeah. All right. Nathan, good stuff. Thanks a million.
Cheers, lads.
It's 11 minutes past 8. We've got a very busy show still to come on OTB AM between now and 10 o'clock. We're going to hear John Duggan's picks on virtual insanity this week. We're talking rugby with Keith Wood. Up next, Daniel Harris is going to talk to us about Manchester United.
OTB AM with Gillette. Put your best face forward with our new and improved razors.